Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education to order and to open up an informational meeting. And prior to calling up the superintendent, I just wanted to recognize budget management analyst, who I have been assured we will be seeing a lot of in the coming months, and that's Jim Carboni.
Carboni.
Any name that ends with a vowel, I'm very happy about. So, and speaking of names ending with a vowel, before I call you up, Superintendent, to the members of the committee, you have a binder. It says Oregon Department of Education, and just so you know, there is a great deal of information in this, and today the superintendent will be focusing on, well, you see there's a tab that says Overview, and the first element will be the superintendent will be discussing, and then there's a green divider, which then we'll have Brian Reeder will be talking about that. And then there is a great deal of other material, agency summary, performance measures, etc. And my understanding is that will not be part of the sort of discussion, but it's for your leisurely reading and analysis for the future. So just kind of for your information. And with that, I would like to call up the Superintendent Susan Castillo to talk about the Department of Education and give that 30,000-foot overview. And thank you very much, Superintendent Castillo, for being here.
Well, thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm here today to talk with you about the Oregon Department of Education, and I will be using our agency acronym today, if that's okay with you, which is ODE, so that I just wanted to clarify that it's Oregon Department of Education. Our job is to ensure the success of all students, and we build the foundation for Oregon's workforce, for the community college system, and for the Oregon University system. And I think we all know that when you have a solid foundation, that the future is more secure. Education is a local, state, and federal matter. Our work is complex and very far-reaching. And so today I'm here to just give you a quick overview of our complex and far-reaching work.
Superintendent Casey, one thing, a really important thing that I forgot to say, just a direction.
Myself.
Pardon me?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, just, no. Well, that wasn't even it. This was something that I forgot to say. Obviously, the task for the superintendent is almost impossible to give in a short period of time a great deal of information, but if we can, just for purposes of time, to the extent possible, wait and ask questions at the end of the presentation, that would be phenomenal. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah. Susan Castillo, State Superintendent of Public Instruction for the State of Oregon. Well, as you turn to slide two, as you can see that everything we do and everyone we work with is committed to ensuring the success of students. We lead the enterprise, the education enterprise, and we're charged with providing a valuable first-rate education to Oregon students. And this means ensuring successful students, quality schools, and accountable systems. On slide three and continuing through slide six, we've provided some very high-level background information. As you may know, Oregon's pre-K through 12 education system is directed by the state constitution and is one of shared responsibility between the legislature, the state board, and the state superintendent. ODE is the support agency for both the superintendent and the State Board of Education. In addition to department staff, the board is supported by Jan McComb. She is the State Board Administrator, and many of you know that she served your body well as a committee administrator for many years, focusing on education work. I believe that leadership is about setting priorities and focusing attention to ensure the success of students. And as ODE's executive head, the superintendent directs and supervises the agency. As you can see on slide five, as the chief executive of the ODE, I set three major priorities for Oregon students and two additional priorities for the agency: closing the academic achievement gap, literacy at every level. We are expanding our focus from primary only a strong focus on the primary, expanding that focus to middle school and high school, and seeing good results from that effort in the area of closing the achievement gap. We continue to make success, although we are not where we need to be. Middle and high school improvement, we continue to work on those efforts, and we believe this latest work by the State Board of Education on the high school diploma requirements is going to be very helpful in those efforts as well. We're working to become more efficient and effective in our department operations and being accountable for results. The federal government's role in education in Oregon continues to grow. ODE receives $480 million in federal funds per year, almost $1 billion per biennium, and most of that money goes out to the field, out to our schools. These funds provide services that include assistance to nearly 72,000 students with disabilities, and in addition, over 230,000 students receive free and reduced price lunches in Oregon. With this funding come many, many federal requirements. And as this slide on page 6 points out, requirements under different education laws can conflict with each other, and that adds to the complexity of ODE's work. And on slide 7, we have a list of who we serve. And as you see, we have students at the top of the list, the 560,000 plus students. In addition to the students and the families and education and community organizations listed on this slide, ODE serves other specialized populations, including the Oregon School for the Deaf, the Oregon School for the Blind, Head Start, and other pre-K providers, private schools, and homeschool students. On slide 8, you'll see our organizational chart. ODE as an agency is focused on continuous improvement of our work. We have streamlined our management structure, creating one that is more cooperative and integrated. For example, prior to 2002, there were 3 deputy superintendents, and now there is 1. We have roughly the same level of staffing for this biennium as we had for the 1999-2001 biennium, and yet we are doing significantly more work. And we'll talk more about that in our detailed presentation to you in March. And now I'd like to talk about each of the offices at ODE. In the superintendent's office, on slide 9, I'd like to first start out with making sure that you know my deputy is Ed Dennis, here, and helps me with my work as state superintendent. The superintendent's office, in addition to the leadership that we provide and other issues listed on slide 9, we are focused on implementing our work around closing the achievement gap, community partnerships, and advancing leadership at the state and local level. We recognize the Teacher of the Year and have been building that program and the Milken National Educator Award. We implement Oregon administrative rules, and we work with Oregon's federal delegation and the U.S. Department of Education, as well as other states. In the Office of Educational Improvement and Innovation, Dr. Salam Noor heads up that area, that office. Salam. And this is the office that focuses on academic content. They focus on consistency and uniformity across the state, so all students have the same high standards and expectations. And this is the office that supported the state board's work on the new high school diploma. This office also administers federal programs such as Title I, which serves our schools that have high numbers of children in poverty, and the Title III programs, which have high numbers of students who have English as a second language. This is also the office that has been leading our work in adolescent literacy and working with experts here in our state and on a national level. In the Office of Student Learning and Partnerships, Dr. Nancy Latini leads that area of the agency, and this is the office that focuses on getting the right services to the right kids. This office provides pre-kindergarten programs and oversees special schools as well as youth correction services. This office also oversees federal requirements around special education and IDEA. On slide 12, the Office of Assessment and Information Services, and Doug Costi heads up that area. Doug? And this is the office that collects and reports data. They're the testing and computer people at the agency. 90% of Oregon students are assessed using computer-based tests, the most efficient and cost-effective way to test students. The Oregon Department of Education administers over 1 million tests per year. And we know that testing is important. Results inform classroom instruction, help ensure public accountability, and allow for continuous improvement. Data is continuing to drive the work that we do at ODE. As the demand for data grows, so does our need for centralization and standardization. And this increase in demand is stressing our infrastructure. In fact, 4 of our 5 policy option packages request investment in our data management infrastructure. Last session, you funded the KIDS pilot project to centralize and standardize students' records, and the governor has included a statewide rollout of the KIDS project in his recommended budget. In the Office of Finance and Administration, that area is led by Sue McGlashan. And in addition to what's listed on slide 13, this is the office that ensures that schools receive their state school fund payments on time and in the correct amounts using data collected from 197 districts and analyzed by ODE staff. And this office also includes the pupil transportation program. Every day during the school year, over 250,000 students are transported to and from school in 5,000 school buses. And we all recognize how important this work is. And this office also administers the child nutrition programs. 42% of students receive free or reduced-priced lunch in our state. And these programs distribute almost $250 million federal dollars to sponsors of the programs for meal reimbursements. ODE oversees a large budget, and we are a key component in quality assurance for the education system. As you can see from the slide on slide 14, the majority of our budget goes out to districts and other local education service providers through the state school fund, granting aid, the common school fund, and even the youth corrections education program, which is run by local education providers such as the education service districts. And debt service that you see on this slide is for education lottery bonds, the proceeds of which were distributed to schools in 1997-99 and in 1999-2001. The department retains about 1% for operations and less than 1% for operating the two special schools, the Oregon School for the Deaf and the Oregon School for the Blind. On slide 15, the message here is that although we have a lot of general fund in our budget, the majority, 99%, is distributed to local education programs. And the same holds true for federal and lottery funds. The bulk of these funding sources goes to local programs. As directed by the 2005 legislature, ODE revised its performance measures and aligned them with the agency's mission, goals, priorities, and initiatives. Slide 16 describes the processes the agency went through to develop its proposed measures for 2007-09. And one area that I'd like to point out is the budgeting to results, or BTR process, described in the last bullet on this slide. I think we were the only state agency to go through this very comprehensive exercise that brought about more focus and discipline to our agency. This process was about examining what we do from the ground up and linking funding to performance and outcomes. We've described this process in more detail in the materials in front of you, and I would encourage you to take a look at pages 7 and 8 in the section entitled Agency Summary, and I think you will be impressed by the very comprehensive exercise that our folks went through at the agency. I'd like to point out that this was our first attempt at the budgeting to results process, and we had a lot of learning to do, and we have learned many things, and we plan to incorporate those lessons learned when we use this process again to bring about more discipline in our focusing on our budget. On slide 17, we appeared before the Joint Legislative Audit Committee in September of 2006, and as a result of our process, we proposed to delete 17 performance measures and reword 13 measures from 2005-07. And we also proposed to establish 19 new measures, and some of these still are under development. The Joint Legislative Audit Committee reviewed and approved our measures, and we will be asking for approval from you as well. And in the next slide, this is a summary of the 07-09 performance measures and how they're linked to our commitment to student success, quality schools, and accountable systems. If you take a look at the chart, for instance, under student success, you'll see that we have two measures on measuring kindergarten readiness, two measures for student achievement, five measures for graduation, and preparing our students for next steps. This chart does not include those performance measures still under development. We have five or six of those, and we'll be talking about our measures in more depth when we return to you in a later presentation. I think you all know when I assumed the role of state superintendent in 2003, there was a lot of work for us to do to improve our performance. We heard a lot of criticisms of the department, and the bottom line is we have made significant progress since 2003. As an agency, we value transparency in our actions and in our budget, and I'm proud that my leadership team here gets it, and we are working hard to implement these values across all the offices of the agency. The charts on slides 19 and 20 summarize our progress over the last 4 years and our goals in several key areas. Under the data area, I just want to point out one really significant change that has happened. We have developed this secure student identifier, which really allows us to take a deeper look at analyzing how our students are doing. And so we are moving, or have moved, from the days of just collecting data to collecting and analyzing data. And once again, everything in education now is about data and what we can learn from the data that we're gathering and how to best use that data to help us make better decisions about our students. I wanted to touch just a little bit about the budget drivers on slide 21. So what is causing our budget to grow? Well, of course, the usual suspects, for both the public and private sector, are employment-related costs, but also some factors unique to ODE. Our caseloads for students with special needs are growing, and so is the demand for public reporting and accountability. For example, the Chalkboard Open Books Project that was about bringing about more transparency about our district's budgets was based on ODE data, and we were heavily involved with that project. We have submitted policy option packages to address several of these budget drivers, and the governor's recommended budget includes several as well. $5 million for teacher and administrator mentoring needs. We are losing too many new teachers because we are not providing them adequate support, and we cannot afford to continue to do that. We have four policy option packages on data management. I mentioned the KIDS project earlier. Assessment literacy training for education stakeholders. We want our educators to know how to make the best use of the assessment information they have, data streamlining, and the development of a growth model. You've probably heard us talk about submitting proposals to the federal government to allow us to develop a new way of how we measure our student progress. It's called a growth model, which will give us more accurate information about how our students are doing. The federal government has not approved our proposal, and we want to continue to develop it anyway and show them that it is a better way. And we have the support widely throughout the education community in Oregon to develop that, and the governor has provided funding in his budget to help us get started on that. Some of the outstanding issues for us, I just have a couple of them listed on slide 22. There are some outstanding factors and issues that will impact our budget that we are continuing to watch closely. And at the federal level, primarily, is the reauthorization of No Child Left Behind. And the Higher Education Act could also have some impacts for our work at the agency. Also, the increased demand for information at all levels will continue to drive the department's workload. For example, as we work more collaboratively with our community partners and their data needs increase, our work will continue to change and grow. The requests at the federal level for information from our department seems to be nonstop. Every time we turn around, there's another request for more data and from other needs, other national initiatives that require states to participate as we're working on building data. So I'm going to end there, and I know that you wanted to leave some time for questions and answers as well. And so I just wanted to say thank you. I know we're going to be back again and can go into more detail on all of these areas. But thank you, and look forward to working with you.
Thank you very much, Superintendent Castillo. And are there any questions from members of the committee? Senator Deckard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just actually a comment, and I've tried never to do this, but and that is to laud the department, or try not to heap praise on, but several of us were involved in the Senate Education Commission and worked really closely with a number of the people that are seated to your right, and it was one of the first time that I worked really closely with the Department of Education, and I was just so impressed with their input is heavily involved in terms of the ideas and the proposals that we're going to consider here in this committee and in the legislature. But I was just so impressed with the work and the product and the department, and so we just throw that praise towards the department that you're running.
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckard, thank you very much. My folks, I'm very proud of this team, and they step up every day doing an incredible job for the children of this state. So I am I have them all here today just because I wanted to make sure that you know who is leading at the agency. I would put my management team against anybody in the private sector. They are just a very talented group of leaders, and so you won't see them assembled like this. They'll be busy doing their work, but we wanted to make sure that they were here for this first meeting and that you got to know who they were and what their areas are. So,
thanks. Thank you very much. Senator Devlin.
Superintendent, in the work group that Senator Deckard and we were on, which was actually outside this building, and I should say wasn't sanctioned by anyone inside this building, that doesn't mean a negative, but it's simply that we were out working on our own. Senator Starr was on that group also. When we were looking at things in terms of improving the K-12 system, and many of those are reflected in proposals that have come forward from your department and the governor, and proposals from that group, and some of them from other groups, there's a lot of similarity. But one of the similarities is that everybody agrees on the early childhood education and expanding that. Everybody agrees that lowering class sizes in first and second grade is a good idea and will show real results in terms of students' achievement. We recently, obviously in the last session, mandated an increase in graduation requirements, which your department is trying to carry out and has been doing a lot of good work on it. But the one thing that we found, and it's my observation, is that it was hard to find things. You know, we can all talk about things to improve graduation requirements. We can all talk about things that are in kids' early years in schools, but we still haven't quite answered this question of how can we make high schools more vital to students? What happens to students other than hormones in middle schools and junior high? And so many of them lose interest at that level. And I just wanted to comment, because it's frustrating, because there doesn't appear to be an easy, you know, there's nothing you can clearly identify that's an easy thing to do, that's identifiable, like lowering class sizes, or moving Head Start from 60 to 80%.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, it's not easy work. It's all very challenging work, but we know what to do to create more success for for students in the state of Oregon. There is no mystery to it. There is incredible research that we can draw from, best practices that we can draw from in our state and across this country that help guide us to make better decisions for kids. And the new graduation requirements, which are really about raising our expectations for all children in the state of Oregon, is at the heart of that work. And so now the next step in that work is creating a statewide implementation task force where we're going to bring, you know, great minds together in our state, and we will plan on how we set the course for having a successful implementation to get our students at this higher level of achievement. And with that will be the plans for what we need to do in the middle schools and in elementary schools to help get them on that track for that higher level of rigor. And what are the capacity issues related to that? But it really is about challenging our students and opening up more opportunities for them to have a more relevant learning experience and having higher expectations for our kids. We have not had our expectations set at a high enough level for what we know our kids are capable of doing. And so as we set off on this new course, which I believe is the absolute right course for helping our students be prepared for this 21st century, we are going to be more successful with more kids. There are some who are concerned that as we raise this rigor that we're going to see the dropout rate increase. The research does not bear that out. When you raise your expectations and you provide the support for children to help them get there, they get there. And that's what our work is going to be about.
Thank you. Thank you. Other questions? Chair's prerogative, and this is, I don't know that it's really possible to answer this question simply, but I was struck when I was looking at the Legislative Fiscal Office's analysis, the governor's budget, and then just some of the material from you, and you mentioned this, I think, three times, the demand for data. Now, I'm very big on empirical evidence and support, but I wonder if, from your perspective, and it, you know, we're, in the end, it's about teaching and learning, and
absolutely,
that's what we're talking about. To what extent is the demand for data becoming something less than useful or helpful? In other words, analyses of data can be very useful and provide information that you need. But when all the policy packages are just, you know, we need to gather more and more data, I wonder if from your perspective you feel as if some of this is sort of getting away from what is even more important for all of you to be doing.
Mr. Chair, it's not just about gathering data. It's about how you're able to use it and about having data systems that are going to deliver what we need, data systems that are aligned throughout our state and data systems where we can share information throughout the education enterprise from pre-K through 20 and making sure that we have alignment and so that we can use this information to make better decisions about our students. When students move through our system, that we are better able to track where they are and that information about them follows them so we can be better prepared right when they make that transition on helping them be more successful in the transitions that they make. Analyzing how we're doing with the resources that we have and how that matches up with student performance. There are just all different kinds of ways that we have more and better data than we've ever had, and it's really about creating systems that are high-performing systems so that we have accurate information to make better decisions about student performance, best practices, trends that we see happening with student success or not student success, and then analyzing that, but then sharing that information for all of us throughout the state. And then there's more and more demand at the federal level for us to have aligned systems with the needs of the federal requirements as well. I'm going to ask Doug Costi if you want to come up and add anything to my explanation. If that's okay with you, Mr. Chair.
Absolutely.
So it's not just about gathering data, but it's a lot bigger than that.
Chair Galizio, members of the committee, for your record, Doug Kofsky, Assistant Superintendent, and I echo Superintendent Castillo's need and desire for more and better data. I think what I can say from our perspective is we've done a great job of collecting data, getting data standardized to some level, but much more work needs to be done. And on the research and analysis side, we're probably not doing our best job in terms of being able to have resources available to do that detailed research and analysis. As Superintendent Castillo mentioned earlier, the enterprise of education is very large, very complex. We have 200 locally elected education agencies in the state, districts and 20 ESDs, and we're working hard. The KIDS initiative is focused on standardizing those data elements, specifically on student information systems. There are so many data elements, and we need to get our heads around it. 30 different implementations of student information systems across the state, getting them to the same level as we did with the chart of accounts on the financial system almost 10 years ago. Now we're moving into the student level or the student layer and trying to standardize those systems as well.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Any other questions? All right, well, thank you very much. Look forward to seeing you in the not-too-distant future.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Packed with lots of questions, hopefully good ones. Thank you again, Superintendent. All right. Now I'd like to call forward Brian Reeder to give us the State School Fund overview.
Chair Galizio, members of the committee, I'm Brian Reeder, Superintendent of the Department of Education. If you can give me a moment, I'll try to boot myself here.
Absolutely. And just for the committee members who came in a little later, FYI, in your packet there's a green divider, and Mr. Reeder's presentation, my understanding, is after the green divider.
That's correct.
Okay. And the rest of the material is for your leisure and reading at a later date. Although tonight, maybe we'll have a test tomorrow.
Online and scored by the system.
That's right.
Okay. What I'd like to do today is sort of give you a pretty broad overview of how Oregon's school funding system works for K-12. What I want to do is answer three basic questions. First one is, where does the funding come from? Second one is, how much money is it? And the third one is, how do we get it out to the people who need it, and that's the school districts and the ESDs to serve Oregon school children. So I'm going to do my best to answer those three questions. Really, there are three basic sources of revenue that Oregon schools have, what we call local, state, and federal sources. And local revenue here, what I've termed local and intermediate, really is comprised of four sources. The first one, and by far the largest one, well over 90% of the local revenue comes from local property taxes. The second source are tuitions, fees, and charges that school districts generate. Tuition payments occur when, for example, a student who lives in another state comes to Oregon to go to school in that other state, or that student's parents will pay tuition to the Oregon school district. Fees and charges would be things like athletic fees and so forth that districts charge to students for typically for non-instructional kinds of activities. Revenue from other local governments really are revenue sharing kinds of activities, relatively minor amounts of money. And then private donations, things individuals or foundations often give money to school districts. Again, a relatively minor source compared to local property taxes. On the state side, really four sources of revenue that go to districts and ESDs. The largest is the state school fund, which is made up of general fund and lottery dollars. The common school fund, which is a fund maintained or managed by the Division of State Lands, which the earnings on which go to school districts. State-managed timber receipts, which are the receipts that are generated when timber on state lands are sold and harvested. And then state grants that are paid to school districts, primarily by the Department of Education. Those are grants outside of our funding formula. And then from the federal government, really three types of revenue that school districts get. The first is direct grants from the federal government. Second are grants that come to the Department of Education and then are passed through to school districts. And the third are federal forest fees, which are payments to both school districts and other local governments to reimburse them for losses in property tax revenue because federal forest land is not subject to local taxes. This slide gives you a sense for the relative magnitudes of those three different sources of revenue, local, state, and federal. And I show you here sort of two different points in time. The first is 1990-91, and that year is important because it was the last year before the fairly dramatic property tax reductions brought about by Measure 5 went into effect. And then the later year, 0405, is the latest year that we have actual audited data from school districts. And the clear message here is that we've had this dramatic shift in funding sources from the local level to the state level in Oregon. Back in 1991, two-thirds of the funding came from local sources, primarily local property taxes, and about one-third from the state. Less than one-third from the state. Today, the local and the state percentages are essentially reversed, so the state now is the primary funder of education in Oregon. Really want to focus on the state school fund now. The state school fund is comprised of general fund dollars, which are made up of both personal and corporate income tax revenues, and lottery revenue. And today, roughly 10% of the state school fund is from the lottery, 90% from the general fund. Just to give you a sense for sort of the large role that the state school fund plays, about 53% of all operating revenue to school districts comes from the state, and over 90% of that is the state school fund. So the state school fund is the name of the game in school funding in Oregon. This graph gives you a sense, it's a recent history of state school fund amounts distributed to school districts, and the roller coaster ride that you've heard about in school funding in Oregon becomes evident when you look at this graph. We saw a dip in 02-03, which was attributable to Oregon's economy going into recession and income tax revenue falling dramatically. We then saw a bit of a recovery in 03-04, but then a dip again in 04-05, and that the 2 years of the 03-05 biennium are an interesting period. What happened there is the legislature appropriated a relatively large amount in the first year of the biennium, 03-04, and a smaller amount in 04-05 in anticipation of Measure 30 passing and generating additional revenue for 04-05. Well, as we know, Measure 30 failed, and so the distribution in 04-05, the resources available for that, fell rather dramatically from the prior year. And then in the most recent biennium, 05-07, we've seen, as Oregon's economy has recovered, fairly significant growth in the amount of state school fund money available. So we're back on the sort of the same kind of trajectory we were on prior to the recession that occurred back in 02-03. So focusing on the state school fund here, an exercise that we go through as a state, and it's carried out by a group called the School Revenue Forecast Committee, is to make an estimate of what we call the essential budget level. And the essential budget level is an estimate of how much needs to be in the state school fund to, in the coming biennium, to fund the same level of services that were provided in the current biennium. So it's a current service level concept. So when you take into account inflation and enrollment growth in the education sector, how much do we need in the coming biennium to do what we did in this one? And that's what the essential budget level is about. This slide gives you the numbers of how we get from actual funding in 05-07 to the essential budget level for 07-09. So we start out with total state and local resources, what we call formula revenue, all the money that goes through the formula in 05-07. Add the amounts required to compensate for inflation and enrollment growth, $720 million. We subtract what we expect local governments to raise on their own, and that leaves the amount that the state needs to fund through the state school fund to provide the same level of services in 07-09. And you're probably all familiar with this number, the $5826.8 million essential budget level, although Jim tells me that may change a little bit because common school fund distributions may be up a bit in the next couple of years, so the essential budget level, the state school fund portion may be able to go down a tad. Okay, so state school fund combined with local revenue, put those together, and it's what we call formula revenue. It's the revenue that the state funding formula distributes out to the school districts and the ESDs in the state. And this slide gives you a sense for where that money comes from and how much it is. And it really, you can see here how on the local side it really is dominated by local property taxes. In the 05-07 biennium, just shy of $2.4 billion in local property taxes out of about $2.6 billion. So over 90% of all local revenue is property taxes. Add to that the state school fund of 5.3, and you come up to the total formula revenue that we had available in 05-07 of $7.88 billion. For comparison purposes, I've also put alongside here what those numbers look like under the governor's proposed budget for 07-09. On the local revenue side, we look at the expected growth in property taxes and other sources of local revenue, and combine that with the governor's proposal of right around $6 billion for the state school fund. Gives us total formula revenue of $8.778 billion. That's about $200 million over the essential budget level. And so when people talk about the opportunity to add back some of what we've lost, that's what they're talking about, that extra roughly $200 million above what inflation and enrollment growth sort of require. little bit about the formula itself. The Department of Education administers Oregon's school funding formula. We distribute, and these are based on 06-07 numbers, about $4 billion of combined state and local money through the formula. Of that $4 billion, about $1.3 billion is already in the hands of the school districts because they've collected that as property taxes, federal forest fees, those other sources of local revenue. The remaining $2.7 billion, the department actually pays to school districts. We make payments on a monthly basis to districts and ESDs, and those two things together, what the locals collect themselves and what we pay them on a monthly basis, represents their formula revenue at the district and ESD level. And I just want to reinforce the point here, because it's one that occasionally causes confusion. The formula, even though we call it a state funding formula, it distributes not just the state money, but the local money as well. And that's an extremely important point. And sort of to give an example, if for a given school district, the formula says they get $10 million and they raise $2 million of that locally, then the state pays them directly the difference, the $8 million. If a different district is entitled to $10 million and they raise $6 million locally, then the state payment to them is $4 million. So that's the equalization function of the formula. Is it determines how much they get in total, and the state makes up the portion that they don't raise locally themselves. Okay, a little bit of a summary here. The formula distributes most local revenue, most state revenue, and some federal revenue, in particular federal forest fees. About 80% of all the operating revenue that districts have available to them comes through the formula. The remaining 20% comes in other forms, primarily federal grants, state grants, and local option property taxes, and I guess in the case of districts up in Multnomah County, the Multnomah County income tax that they had in place up there for a few years. Of the formula revenue amount, 95% of that is distributed on a per student basis, what we call a per weighted student basis, and we'll talk about student weights here in just a moment. And then the remaining 5% is given out, it's distributed in ways other than on a per student basis, and those are transportation grants, high cost disability grants, and facility grants, and I'll give you a little bit of detail about each of those in a moment as well. Of the total amount that we give out through the formula, 95.25% goes to school districts. The remaining 4.75% goes to ESDs. The purpose of the funding formula is to equalize funding across districts in a way that adjusts for costs that are outside the district's control. And that's the role of the weights in the formula, is to make those adjustments for cost variation that different districts face. The formula recognizes that, based primarily on differing student characteristics, that some students are more expensive to educate than others, and the weights help with make that adjustment to get more money to those districts with more high-cost students. The nature of the costs outside of districts' control are, first and foremost, students with special needs, and the two largest categories in Oregon are special education students and students whose first language is not English, students being served by English as a second language programs. Districts also have differing transportation costs driven largely by geography and the density of their student population. Small schools, small remote schools in Oregon also have fairly different cost structures than larger urban schools or suburban schools because of their isolation and small size. School districts that have a disproportionate number of hire experienced teachers because of the salary schedules of school districts tend to have higher than average compensation costs, primarily salaries. And districts who are growing and adding new facilities have needs for equipment, you know, desks, chairs, lab equipment, and so forth to equip those new facilities. And so we also have what we call a facilities grant to give additional dollars to those districts. So the way we get more money out to these high-cost districts is through these student weights and through these grants that are not based on a per-student basis, but are based, they're largely reimbursements for actual costs. The transportation grant is a reimbursement-type program. The high-cost disability grant is a reimbursement program. And then we'll talk a little bit more about the details of the teacher experience adjustment as well in a few moments. But first, the student weights, because that really is what drives the formula. Every student in Oregon gets what we often call the first weight or the regular weight of 1.0. So we count every student. But then students with special needs get additional weights, and you can see them listed here. Special education students get a full additional weight. ESL students an additional half weight. Students served by pregnant and parenting programs an additional full weight. Students in poverty a quarter weight, and so forth. The last one is an interesting one because it's not based on student characteristics, but it's the small, what we call the small school correction. The way we administer that and the way the law specifies that is that it's based on the size of the school. They get additional weights in the formula. So it's an interesting mechanism where we treat the small schools as though they had extra students or extra weights. And just a sort of footnote here, there is a limit in the law that any particular student can have only two extra weights and then combined with their first regular weight, a total of three weights. And so that's a limit in the law. As a practical matter, it's almost impossible for any particular student to actually get that many weights, but it is specified in the law as a limit. Beyond the student weighting, the other adjustments that are intended to compensate for varying costs are listed here. The first one, the high-cost disability grant, reimburses districts for expenditures above $30,000 for individual special education students. The transportation grant reimburses districts from 70 to 90% of their eligible transportation expenditures. Small school correction gives additional weights in the formula to small schools. The teacher experience adjustment adds a fixed dollar amount, $25 per weighted student, to the formula for districts who have higher experienced teachers than the state average. And then the facility grant gives grants to school districts to equip new classrooms. I want to get a little bit into the workings of the formula here, but only briefly. We start out in the formula with the big pot of money, the roughly $4 billion, and that is a big pot of money. I'd like to play in that big pile of money sometime. But off the top of that, we take the amounts that are going to be distributed through the transportation grant, the high-cost disability grants, and the facility grants. That removes roughly $400 million from the pot, and the remaining $3.6 billion is sent out on a per-weighted student basis. It's what we call the general purpose grant. And that general purpose grant is expressed or it's calculated on a per-weighted student basis. So the first step in the process is to determine for each district how many weighted students they have. And that's a relatively straightforward calculation. We take the sum of all their first weights, what we call ABMR, add the additional weights for students with special needs and also the weights for the small school correction, and we arrive at what we call ADMW or weighted ADM. And then we compare that for each district to what their ADMW was in the prior year, and they're funded on the higher of the two. So the rationale for that is that districts who are losing enrollment have certain fixed costs that don't go down as their enrollment declines, and so they are funded at a slightly higher level, the level of their students in the prior year, to compensate for those fixed costs. And then the only adjustment that we make in calculating the general purpose grant is the one I referred to earlier for teacher experience, and that is for each year of experience in a district that a district's average teacher experience differs from the statewide average, they get a $25 adjustment. If they have higher experience, then it's an upward adjustment. If they have lower experience, then it's a downward adjustment. So in the formula itself, here's what it looks like. You take in calculating the general purpose grant, you take the number of weighted students in a district, you multiply that by $4,500 plus any teacher experience adjustment that that district may qualify for, and that tells you how much each district gets. And then we sum those up and compare it to how much total money we have to send out. And if the two don't equal, then we apply this ratio to make sure that we send out all the money. And what you'll notice here is this $4,500 is set in the law. It doesn't change from year to year. So right now we're distributing roughly $5,700 per student. So this ratio has to be somewhat greater than one to make sure we distribute all the money out to the districts and the ESDs, actually in this case the districts. And then the total formula revenue of the district, we take that general purpose grant, add in their transportation grant, their high cost disability grant, their facility grant, and that comes out to the total amount that they get through the formula. Then the last step here is to determine how much we actually pay them, how much the department actually sends to them each month. And so, as mentioned earlier, we subtract how much they raise locally to determine how much the department actually needs to cut a check for. And finally, the ESD portion of the formula. ESDs are funded in Oregon based on the funding levels of their constituent school districts. So it's a relatively straightforward formula. For each ESD, we add up the funding of their constituent districts, and then we simply take a percentage of that, and that's how much the ESDs get through the ESD formula. And then again, depending on how much their local revenue is, the department cuts them a check to make up the difference. One sort of characteristic of the ESD formula that's different than the district formula is that if the local revenue of an ESD is greater than the amount they're entitled to through the formula, then the difference must be paid out to their constituent districts. And this is part of the formula that was developed, I believe, two or three biennium ago when the ESD formula was overhauled. Just some contact information here. The person at the department who is responsible for the day-to-day administration of the formula is Mike Wiltfong. If you have questions about particular formula items, you can contact Mike, or you can always contact me if you have questions about the formula. And just for additional information about the formula or any other the data that goes into it, you can go to the department website at this address. So with that, I am happy to answer questions you may have about the state school fund or the formula.
Thank you very much, Mr. Reeder. You just reminded me why during the campaign it's very difficult to explain the funding formula and how schools are funded in Oregon in 30 seconds when you're at the door. So I appreciate that. So questions? Senator Saar.
Thank you. You mentioned that 80% of the funding comes from the state or from basically your local property taxes, but there's 20% that's funded outside of the formula. Would it be possible that at a later date to get the breakdown of which districts have local options and how much they are on a per pupil basis in the various communities?
Chair Galizio, Representative Starr, absolutely. I'm sorry, Senator Starr.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Devlin.
Just to clarify that issue, though, of course, the local option is not part of the formula. That's actually the way it is written.
That's correct.
And that variance in terms of how much comes locally, I think, can vary from the low side, might be in the low teens, in terms of the amount from local property taxes and other sources, to a few districts that are all locally funded in terms of their local property taxes generate enough to actually meet the state standard for a particular biennium. I think Seaside was one of them that's right on the edge. Sisters is another.
I'm interested in the funds that are outside of the formula.
Yeah. But the local option, Mr. Chairman, the local option was specifically designed to be outside the formula. And I always have to remind people it isn't as if it's something extra given to that district. It's the people in that district taxing themselves to be able to do that. But I did have one question, Mr. Chairman, if I could. This is only personal interest rather than... you mentioned a number that's part of the formula. It's a very small factor. But could I get for like the last 10 years the average teacher experience that's went into the formula? Because my understanding is we went through a period of time in terms of, the peak of PERS retirements, the average age of teachers, too, because we've gone through this in practically every area of government, and even in the private sector, that there are a lot of people that are reaching those ages where they're retiring now. And I just wanted to see what's happened to the average age in terms of average age of teachers, not age of teachers, I shouldn't say that, average experience of teachers over those periods.
Chair Galizio, Senator Devlin, absolutely. We have all that data back probably close to 20 years. And you're right, we had this experience where there was a, if you looked at the age structure of teachers, there was this bubble where a rather large share of teachers were coming close to retirement age at roughly the same time that the PERS system was encouraging them to get out fast. And so we had this 3 or 4 year period where retirements were extremely high relative to historical levels, and that tended to do two things. It held the average salaries down as high paid teachers were replaced by lower paid teachers at the low end of the salary scale, and it also had the effect of reducing the average years of experience of teachers.
One follow-up, please.
Follow-up?
Representative Morgan and I serve on a separate committee and often look into more details of this, actually, with Mr. Reeder. How comfortable are we really with the materials and services adjustments that we make in terms of determining EBL with school districts? I mean, we're using the adjustment that DAS uses, Department of Administrative Services uses, for materials and services. How accurately do we believe that actually reflects the experience of school districts?
Chair Galizio, Senator Devlin, that's a good question. The School Revenue Forecast Committee uses a forecast of the U.S. implicit price deflator as the measure of inflation for services and supplies. And how that correlates with this actual experience of Oregon school districts in terms of how much they pay for paper and other supplies and professional services and so forth. It's not something that that committee has looked at very closely. One thing that the department has done as part of the quality education model process is break down those services and supplies into a number of categories, such as textbooks and energy and so forth, a more level of detail than the Revenue Forecast Committee uses. The two processes tend to come out to roughly the same place. And what that tells me is that the implicit price deflator is not a bad measure for services and supplies. But obviously, in cases where we see a spike in things like energy costs, we may see it diverge a little bit from that. But it's probably worth looking into a little further.
Mr. Chairman, the reason I ask the question is because what we most commonly hear from school districts is obviously the price of energy. And, of course, portion of that is already in the transportation portion, which is outside the forecast. But a portion of that, obviously, is the heating of their buildings. And then when we all think about textbooks and what's happened to the price of textbooks, we kind of think that this is kind of out of proportion to what we're seeing being the adjustment. But I know that there are a lot of factors that go into this, but we commonly just hear that the adjustment is well below what many school districts are experiencing. So.
Thank you, Senator. Did you want to... Were you going to comment on that?
You don't have to, but it looked like you were about.
Chair Blasio, Senator Devlin, you're correct. I mean, we do hear that regularly, particularly about energy. And so, as I said, it may be worth digging into a little bit further just to see whether that implicit price deflator is really telling us what we want it to tell us.
Thank you. Representative Morgan?
Thank you. I think it was it's very interesting that Senator Devlin's questions are going in much the same direction that I was interested in gathering more information on. First of all, thank you for the overview. I think that you've done a great job of communicating one of the most complex funding formulas. I think this one and wildfire fighting take the cake. Complex funding formulas. Going back again to the inflation component of computing the EBL and the School Revenue Forecast Committee, I think the biggest component of costs is salaries, because this is a real people-intensive business. Is educating kids involves a lot of people, and I can't remember the details, and I'm hoping you'll refresh my memory on the details of the roll-up costs that relate to payroll numbers and not just the salaries, but also the benefits side of the thing. How do we, as a state, take a look at how to forecast what the increase is in that area?
Chair Blasio, Representative Morgan, actually, in the process that the Senate or the School Revenue Forecast Committee goes through, we spend a lot of time breaking compensation into its components and looking at each component in as much detail as we can. So, for example, on the salary side, we look at teacher salaries, administrator salaries, classified salaries separately. We break out retirement PERS separately. We break out what we call contract benefits, which is really dominated by health insurance, separately. We break out federal payroll taxes separately and workers' compensation payments separately. So we break it down into its components and then look at how each of those components varies and how we expect them to grow over time. And so, for example, teacher salaries have been growing fairly slowly in Oregon, largely because of this turnover phenomenon where more highly paid teachers are retiring and they're being replaced by lower paid teachers with less experience, and that tends to keep the average salary growth down. The PERS rate, because it's a share of salary, grows at the same rate as does salaries, as long as the rate doesn't change. But as we know, the rate has been bouncing up and down, the PERS rate, over the last 4 or 5 years. And so that's one of the biggest challenges that this group faces, is predicting what the PERS rate is going to be 2 years from now. And I guess maybe even a larger challenge is trying to predict what health insurance costs are going to do in the future, because we've seen two things happening. The first is that they've been growing at 9 to 12% per year, premiums have. But on the other hand, districts have started putting caps on the amount they're willing to pay, and so that employees are required to pick up the difference, and that tends to hold district costs a little lower than they would be, but it tends to put pressure in the bargaining process on the salary side of things to make up for that. So it's an interesting dynamic. But what we try to do is break it into the components and look at them each separately so we can do a better job on each piece.
May I have a follow-up? Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the department then must have done quite a bit of extra work on this over the last 2-3 years in terms of collecting the data, because my recollection is that when we discussed this issue a couple of years ago, the department was not the repository of the contracts, and so it was very difficult to put the information together.
Chair Galizia, Representative Morgan, the department does not have, we don't collect data on teacher contracts, but we do collect data on teacher salaries for individual teachers. And we also know their years of experience and their age and their education and so forth. So we have very good data on actual salaries paid. We tend to use a historical data on those salaries and to make a forecast. Ideally, we would have detailed data on teacher contracts, but we simply don't collect that. My personal view is that the salary data that we do have is very good data, and is the history it provides us with a very good.
So may I ask?
Absolutely.
So would you say then that based on the model that you use to construct that piece of the work that the School Revenue Forecast Committee does, that it tracks with what actually happens in the real world as you look forward for the period of time that you're forecasting for?
Chair Galizia, Representative Morgan, the model has predicted fairly well. It's a statistical model, and it tracks history extremely well, as most statistical models do. But the test of the model is how well it predicts, and the model has actually gotten better in the last few years as we've sort of added components to it to take into account more of the dynamic factors out there. For example, the amount of total funding in the system determines how many teachers districts are able to hire, and the more they're able to hire, the more of them that will be new, inexperienced teachers, and that tends to hold the average salary down. In times when funding is not growing very rapidly, and districts actually have to lay off teachers, they tend to lay off teachers on the low end of the salary scale, and that can actually drive the average salary up. And so the model, we try to make the model more dynamic in that sense, and it predicts much better now than it has before.
Thank you. If I can, would indulge me for one more question.
Representative Morgan?
The local option grants, where do they fit in all the mix of this?
Chair Galizia, Representative Morgan, local option grants are grants given to school districts that pass local option levies. And the way they work is if a district's assessed value per weighted student is below the 75th percentile, then they qualify for an equalization grant from the state. And that the way the grant works is they get a grant that would bring them up bring them up to the point where they would raise the same revenue as if they did have the 75th percentile of assessed value per student. It's a bit complicated, but essentially it takes low assessed value districts and gives them a grant so that they raise revenue and makes them look like a higher assessed value district. And that, in the past, that the funds available to make those grants have been a separate appropriation by the legislature. Right now we have three or four districts that qualify for those grants, and they total about, in 05-07, they totaled about $1.2 million.
So may I have just clarification there? So the origin of those funds, is it a draw off the top of the state school fund appropriation, or is it a completely separate appropriation from the general fund?
Chair Galizio, Representative Morgan, historically it's been a separate appropriation. It has not been a draw off the state school fund. In the governor's proposed budget for 07-09, the 6.06 billion has 400,000 of that is for local option equalization grants. So it's in that big number, but technically it's not part of the state school fund.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for those questions, Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Reeder, just a couple of questions regarding local district disbursements. When exactly are those disbursements calculated, and do they take into account student movement in and out of districts and or dropouts?
Chair Galizio, Representative Edwards, the distribution process starts about 8 months prior to the beginning of each school year, and at that point we gather estimates from school districts about what their student enrollment will be, what their ADM will be, and what the added student weights will be. And we also gather data from them on their expected local revenue. And using that information and the state school fund appropriation from the legislature, as well as expected revenue from federal sources, from the federal forest fees, we start the distribution process in July of the school year. At that point, we run the distribution formula to determine how much each district gets through the formula. As the school year progresses, we start getting more actual data rather than forecasted data, and we enter that into the formula and make adjustments along the way. So the basic measure of enrollment, which we call ADMR, is calculated as a daily average throughout the year. So it does account for movement of students in and out of particular districts.
Mm-hmm.
So if a student is in a district for half the year, they get counted as half a student for that district. Then they're in a different district the other half, and the other district gets to count them for that half of the year. The formula does not, I guess in some sense it does take into account dropouts, because if a student drops out mid-year, then they're not counted for the portion of the year that they're gone. So in that sense, yes, it does.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Reeder.
Senator Devlin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First brief comment. Representative Morgan actually served on the outside group also that was looking at these issues, and you'll probably be reminded during this committee meeting, future committee meetings, that Representative Morgan and I can sit and talk about these issues for hours.
Don't worry, it happened to all of you over time.
But I did have a specific question, and that is maybe a broader question for the Department of Education that relates to the school formula. When the rates were developed in the early stages of putting the formula in place, how valid do we believe that the weighting system was? And what evidence do we have to back up questions about how valid the weighting system is? I'm going to put that in the background of knowing that every time we debate any changes in the formula in this building, they're debated ad nauseum. and we change very little, simply because anytime you change the formula, you have winners and losers. But I often am asked, you know, what is the basis for the weighting that was put into the formula? And I've never really had a very clear answer on that. And of course, we've gotten into the discussions with school districts that the formula is not an, it's not an appropriations formula in the sense that we are giving you so much for ESL instruction or so much to assist students who come from poverty. It's basically a way to determine fairness in the formula. So anything the department could give me that gives me some basis for how the formula was developed would be helpful.
Chair Blasio, Senator Devlin, I'll give it a shot. I actually came out of a House committee meeting earlier this afternoon where Steve Meyer was asked that same question, and Steve was around back then and I wasn't, so he's a better person to answer the question, but this question does come up regularly, and I think the general answer is that the legislature did the best job they could of gathering the research and the data back then. And at the time, there were some national studies about special education costs and English as a second language costs, and there was evidence from other states on how much they were spending on those programs. But the evidence was pretty spotty, and that to the extent possible, the weights proposed for Oregon were based on that research, national research, and the evidence from other states, but there was little, if any, evidence directly from Oregon, the Oregon experience. I would say, though, that more recent research in the last 10 years that looks at spending and student performance can shed some light on the question of what level the weights in some sense should be if we're going to fully compensate for cost so that all students have an equal opportunity to achieve standards. So the findings of some of the more recent research I think can be instructive for us if we're going to revisit that question.
Mr. Chair, if I could add.
Absolutely,
Superintendent. So for us, I think, you know, we're ready to have the conversation whenever the legislature would like to have the conversation about taking a look at the formula. I think the biggest obstacle to changing is really, as you said, the dynamics of how the formula works. Every time you make an adjustment, there are winners and losers. And so it's getting legislative agreement around any changes that would need to be made to the formula would be the major hurdle of making adjustments. But we would, you know, we're ready to have that conversation on taking a look at how it works and how those adjustments are made.
Thank you. Representative Jensen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In relationship to the special ed, the formulas, is there not some federal cap on the percentage of the students that may be eligible for? Is there?
Chair Blasio, Representative Jensen, there's no federal cap. Oregon's funding formula has a cap of 11%, so 11% of a district
right.
Students qualify, but I'm not aware of any federal cap.
Okay. Can I follow that?
Absolutely.
Can you tell me how does that 11% stack up as far as the various districts around the state? Are there districts that exceed or could exceed that cap, and are there districts that are less than that cap? Enlighten me a little, if you could, about that.
Chair Blasio, Representative Jensen, answers yes to both questions, and I know this only because Steve Meyer presented some data about 2 hours ago next door. There are 25 districts in the state who are below the 11% cap, which leaves about 173 that are at the cap or above, We have quite a few that are above the cap. The statewide average is about 13%, and I know for a fact that we have some districts up close to 17 or 18%.
And editorial comment.
Yeah, this is the final editorial, yes.
It strikes me this panacea to look for equalization has just run into a problem. If there is merit to extra pay for this, and some of the districts have more significantly larger handicap students.
There's the equalization fund.
Well,
a special fund that equalizes for high cost.
Burning question.
Not a question. It's an announcement.
Okay. Not Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. The Revenue Committee will have two bills next week. I think are posted now, or they will be tomorrow, on aspects of the formula. The superintendent may be particularly interested in that, given her statement a moment ago.
Senator Saar. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a very generic question. It should be relatively easy to answer. Do we have the number of students in public schools from kindergarten through 12th grade? Do we know exactly how many kids there are? Say within 100?
Chair Bellizio, Senator Starr, yes, we do, and we know their names.
Good. Can you give me, can you give me the number?
I can give you the exact number for last year, and I can give you an approximate number for this year because we're still finalizing the data. 559,215 in the 05-06 school year, 563,000 and something in the 06-07 school year.
Perfect. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. You absolutely passed your exams. You're on for your dissertation, so congratulations.
Yeah.
I really wanted to thank you, Mr. Reeder, and Superintendent Castillo for a fantastic job. Thank you for all for showing up. And before my committee leaves, I mean, you're absolutely dismissed, but before you leave, I just wanted to alert the committee of a tentative plan for a road hearing. February 21st, which is a Wednesday, and the idea at Portland State University, it would be around this time, the latter half of the day, and obviously details forthcoming. Again, this is tentative, but I just wanted to kind of give you the FYI, save the date, Wednesday, February 21st, Portland State University.
So we can have like a 4:30 start time or a 3 o'clock start time?
Well, that's something we should all discuss. So.
Mr. Chair,
sure,
it's easy.
Yeah,
at
4:30
is
easy.
Yeah.
Representative Morton. Would you have the LFO staff email that to our email so that we can get that on our schedule?
Absolutely. Done.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Superintendent Casilla.
If I could. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make sure that I mentioned that Barry Reeder is also a part of our management team. I didn't have him on the list of people that I introduced earlier, so.
Duly noted. Duly noted. Thank you all very much, and I close this informational hearing, and we're adjourned. Thank you.